You're listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 517. We're all gonna die. Hello, and welcome to the Punk News Podcast. I'm Adam White, recording for you under a blanket here in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Where it is slightly colder than I want it to be at this point in the year. Joining me on tonight's show from north of me, so I really shouldn't complain. We have news editor M. Moore. Hi, M.
Hello.
Is it cold?
Yeah, it is. It's not too bad. Yesterday was worse. There's still a bit of snow, but other than that, not too bad.
I mean, it's not Saskatchewan cold or anything, but it's colder than I would prefer at this point. And then triumphant from defeating Rudy Giuliani in court, we have Mr. John Gentile, Philly lawyer extraordinaire.
That's like saying triumphantly returning from beating up a toddler, this grown man. But Adam, did you know? First of all, Adam, can you explain to the listeners what the last waltz is?
The film about the band's big triumphant final guest filled performance, and
precisely
with Neil Young's big rock of cocaine in his nostril as he's playing.
Right. I'm glad you bring it up. So Neil Young is in the final portion of that video. And in the video, he's standing next to, I always forget her name. She's one of the singer-songwriters, not Joan Baez. Who's the singer-songwriter in The Last Waltz? I'll look it up. Anyways, if you look at Neil Young's T-shirt, he's wearing a T-shirt that has two people 69ing on it. And I'm not even kidding you.
Is there a point to this, or just you're really impressed with this?
That no one, I mean, did you know that? Like, I think that just came out like today, that like 50 years ago, Neil Young was wearing a T-shirt that had two people 69.
I'm image searching this. He's next to Joni Mitchell during that.
Joni Mitchell, yes. Yeah,
but the he's wearing a jacket.
What's the T-shirt under the jacket, Adam?
Oh, wait. It is.
Oh, there you go. In this picture, Joni does not look happy.
Would you be saying that to some creep? I mean, honestly, like if you were at like a frat party or whatever, and some dude was wearing a T-shirt with two people 69 on it, you'd be like, "What a loser! Like, what a total bro!" But it's Neil Young.
You see, I had this brief conversation the other day with former Punk News editor Justin, and it was Neil Young's 75th birthday, I think, recently. So Twitter was all, wishing Neil Young happy birthday and sharing their various gifts and memes and shit that people do on the internet. And someone went and posted this group of pictures of just Neil Young hanging out with dogs. But they were all Neil hanging out with dogs in like 1972. And I don't know, like, I'm so used to seeing Neil Young in my head as this fucking curmudgeon that he's become, that seeing all of these pictures of like 1972 Neil Young was really blowing my mind, because he has this, like, at that point in his life, at least, like, lanky surfer proto grunge thing going on, where he's got like super long hair. And he's got this like goofy, frattish kind of look to him at the time. And he was also like kind of hot. And it was, I'm looking at all this and I'm like, damn, like Neil Young, 1972 is like, he had like a whole thing going. I'm kind of jealous of it. Like, I don't think I can do it. I'm too old now that I could achieve. I don't know how old he would have been in 1972, but like, I couldn't do that look. But it was a good look. So If you young Punk Juice podcast listener are looking for something to emulate to, like, you know, get out there in the world and, you know, really show the post pandemic universe how much of a weird party burnout you've become, try to go for that look.
You know, according to Sonic Youth, Neil Young loves strippers as well, FYI. So that kind of explains the shirt to a degree.
That strikes me as a shirt where you're like, where you go like, oh, wait, we're filming this? Hold on. And then you turn around and you run back into wardrobe and you get the most obnoxious thing that you can.
Yeah, if you're like 14, if you're 14, you think that's hilarious. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, but that's, I mean, I'm fascinated by the mindset of like early 70s. I mean, like Last Waltz was not early 70s, right? Like, when was Last Waltz?
72, I think.
Was it not a little bit later than that?
76,
you're right. Yeah, 76. Right. So I don't know. That's older than I'm picturing in my head, but hey, what are you gonna do? You know what I heard? And it stuck with me ever since I heard this fact, and I don't know even know if it's real, but it sort of breaks me because I'll never accomplish anything now. Apparently, like, Neil wrote Down by the River, Cinnamon Girl, and what was the third one? Shit. Down by the River, Cinnamon Girl, and other big hit from that same
Pocahontas
era. No, come on.
On the Beach?
You're just jumping all over eras here.
Cortez the Killer?
Oh, Jesus. Okay, and the other big hit from the same record that Down by the River was on. Anyways, he wrote those three songs, which are at least two of them are like 5, 6, 7 minute songs with like huge long like extended guitar solos and stuff like that in them. He wrote those three tracks, those three classic hits, like in bed with a fever in an afternoon. Cowgirl on the Sand, right? Apparently he wrote all three of them like in a day when he had a fever.
Apparently he also loves to get the $20 two-for-one lap dance special. You know, I heard that
well,
too.
Well, shit, if you can churn out stuff of that quality in that amount of time, I guess you deserve a two-for-one lap dance special. So anyways, yeah. So happy belated birthday, Neil Young. You were a, you know,
total weirdo, and that's why we love him.
Yeah. Keep on. So anyways, what are we talking about this week?
We're talking about mail.
We're talking about mail.
You said podcast, yeah. You can always use podcast at punknews.org. This is from Jim K. I know you boneheads love talking about records almost as much as I do. Are you getting anything for Record Store Day Black Friday? I don't even think they should be doing it during the current pandemic. It's an easy decision for me because there is absolutely no punk at all. This is the first time that they haven't had any punk at all in the Record Store Day since the abysmal Record Store Day 2013, when they only had one a year, not four. And that's from Jim K.
I will reflect Jim's overall ambivalence to it because like I had no desire to do it this year. And then when I saw the list, it kind of cemented it. And I'm like, you know what? Like if I'm being told not to go places, then it really makes it easy for me if I can not go places because there's nothing to entice me to go places. John, I know that's the opposite for you and you bought the farm, but there was nothing I wanted.
Oh, this year? Oh, yeah, honestly, I thought this year, I mean, there was four Record Store Days. There's been three so far. A lot of great stuff, man. The Alice Cooper, the Pogues, the Gwar. Those were the big heavy hitters for me. The Judas Priest is all right. But honestly, the Alice Cooper one is probably the real winner. I mean, I guess we've been talking about Alice Cooper like every week lately, but he's been putting out a lot of interesting stuff lately. He put out a live album from 82, which was a very unique period for him and was really good. And plus, the Gwar record was really cool. It was Gwar before they were Gwar's Death Piggy, and that was a cool record too. So I got to say, man, I really feel that they upped the ante. Prices have dropped back a little bit, which is good. And so, yeah, man, I mean, all things considered, I think they did a pretty good job this year for Record Store Day.
I'm just like, I feel like it doesn't cater to me. Like even at the best of times when we don't have to like choose between you know, Super Virus or Records. It's been a long time since there's been a particular Record Store Day thing that I really needed to get out there and go get in line for, that is just, you know, stuck in my brain that I need to get. And God, like what would have been the last thing that I would have went out there for? Like there was that one year where there was a Joe Strummer Gangsterville 10-inch, was it 10-inch even, or 12-inch or whatever that they put in?
12-inch.
Was it 12-inch? And then there was a year where there was a couple cool, like, Mets splits that one year. You sent me one, John, where they did, a split with, like, Mission of Burma, and then a split with, like, Swami John Rice the one time. You know, there's been, like, reissues of Attack and Black stuff that I wanted as, like, a nerd, but, like, I don't know. Like, there, it's been a long time since I have, like, been really, really seen something that I've needed to jump in there and get. And I think that's largely a symptom of me being way too far down my, like, you know, like, tiny regional weirdo band hole. Like, they're not releasing Record Store Day stuff in the first place. So it just isn't going to happen. What about you, Em?
Not doing Record Store Day, still looking into getting a record player.
That's a pretty good reason.
Yep.
All right, well, they have, this is from ARMZ, A-R-M-Z. I was troubled by your dismissal of Bob Dylan on episode 514. Bob Dylan could be the original punk rocker. He had the record, I think it means he hated the record industry. He had the record industry, but I think it means he hated the record industry. He hated big business. When people tried to make him the hippie symbol, he rejected that and attacked them with his electric guitar at the famous 1966 tour. Also, he smoked. If you haven't listened to Dylan, you should listen to Blonde on Blonde. Listen to Rainy Day Women and tell me that isn't the first junkie punk drug song ever. Yeah, yay, Bob. Boo, not liking Bob. Yeah, podcast. And that's from ARMZ.
Did we shit on Dylan? I mean, like, we shit on, I think, like, Dylan and the Dead, because I had to listen to that a lot. But
that's a bad album. That's a bad album.
No, we're not particularly shitting on Dylan. At least I hope that's not the vibe.
No, I like Dylan a lot. I'm a big fan. I'm not a huge fan, but I'm a big fan.
So seeing him live a few years ago was one of the stranger experiences in my major arena concert going career, because he does not do anything that you would expect. And if you walk in there expecting Dylan to, like, at all perform a show that is somewhat reminiscent of any Dylan recording that you've heard, it is not in the cards. Like,
that's rad.
Well, it's rad, but it's like, it's not, it struck us as a symptom of age and less a symptom of being, like, an iconoclastic individual. A few times I've seen Neil Young, he's pretty famous for showing up and playing whatever he wants. And sometimes you get the hits, and sometimes, you know, he'll just show up and play Greendale in its entirety or something. And you just have to deal with that, because Neil Young is not there to be a nostalgia act for you, right? And he's like, his entire, he's just infamous for doing it. Like, you kind of know walking in the door. Dylan was strange, because you got the impression that he put together this show around the current weaknesses that he might have as a live performer due to his age or his voice or anything like that. Like first of all, he sounded like he made, like, Tim Armstrong sound like an angel. Like, it was, you know, he sounded like a fucking bag of gravel the whole time. But more than that, he did not touch a guitar the whole time. He played at a keyboard the entire performance. The band he put together for the show was amazing. As far as being really good session players, like, this was like top of the tops. Everyone was just playing their ass off. They were doing incredible things. But they were all playing, like, complete reconceptualizations of songs that you might recognize combined with songs that you just wouldn't recognize at all. So it was a, like, it was cool from being able to go and see a bunch of like absolute top shelf musicians put on a show. But, you know, there was nary a note that was played during that whole thing that the casual observer would have like gone, oh, that's Dylan. It was just like, it was something else. And, you know, it was a old man that sounded like a cement mixer playing a keyboard for a while.
It sounds rad as hell to me, man. I mean, I wish I had seen Dylan. I mean, I still hypothetically could. Him and Paul McCartney, I'd like to see. Bro.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, we have one more email, and this says, I'll be traveling down to Miami and would like to visit some gentlemen's clubs. Should I visit the Peppermint Rhino or the Top Secret Club? And this is signed Neil Y. I don't know who that is, Adam. Do you know Neil Y is? I don't know. I mean,
Liverpool Neil Y. Always asking us the important questions. Yeah. I'm glad you could just pull those names out of your hat, though. That was good.
Actually, while you were talking, I wrote them down because the Peppermint Rhino, I think, is a famous strip club in Las Vegas, I think, or maybe Los Angeles. And, well, the Top Secret Club I made up. But the Peppermint Rhino was a famous place, I think.
We'll find it. We'll find out in a really fun Google adventure after the show. So, all right. We're going to talk about
some of the podcast at punknews.org. We love getting your mail.
That's what we do. Yeah. Let's play a song and then we'll talk about some of the news that happened this past week. M, John, it's one of you.
And play a song.
All right. I've been listening to a lot of Refused, so I'm going to play Faceless Corporate Violence. And that's off of their new EP, The Malignant Fire. Enjoy.
Faceless Corporate Violence!
Back, that was Refused. So we're gonna talk about some I guess we'll talk about some old bands before we get to some of the new band stuff. So first of all, this story that comes up every year is back. It's the punk rock version of War on Christmas, I guess. It's just you know, everyone needs the clicks. It's time. And it's the Pogues controversy. So it's back. So we're getting close to Christmas. Of course, that means everyone's going to start playing Fairy Tale of New York, which, controversies aside, is the only good Christmas song. So that's...
You're talking about Christmas rapping by the waitresses, Adam.
All right, I'll take your word for that one. So anyways, so Fairy Tale came out in 88. BBC's played the song during the holiday season since then. And the BBC has now stated that it may not play the song this year due to its evergreen controversial lyrical content. Now, if you do not know the lyric that we're talking about, the song is a duet between Shane McGowan and Christy McCool. And there is a point when they are quarreling, they're yelling at each other, and they yell to each other, "You're a bum, you're a punk, you're an old slut on junk, lying there..." Why can't I read our own thing? "Lying there almost dead on a drip on that bed, you scumbag, you maggot, you cheap, lousy faggot, happy Christmas, you arse, I pray God it's your last." Or it's our last. Now, I've totally butchered that because I can't read.
It's your last.
But in any case, yeah, I'm having a stroke here.
It's your last. Adam, that's almost like a better line, honestly.
What did I say?
You said that the line is, "We hope it's our last," but you said, "I hope it's your last," which is a much more vicious.
So anyways, they're yelling at each other. So less controversially, Shane's character calls Christy's character a slut. The more controversial one is that Christy calls Shane a faggot. So that word has, of course, become the point of contention about this song and has for years. So the BBC this year has initially said they weren't going to play the song at all. And that received both support and backlash from listeners, as you'd expect. So now BBC Radio 1's come to a compromise on this. They're going to play an edited version of the song where McCool says, "You're cheap and you're haggard," instead of "you cheap, lousy faggot." And now that line came from a Top of the Pops recording of the track where they had censored it for TV. In that version, the word "slut" is also silenced. So the BBC explained the change, stating, "Radio 1 has decided younger listeners who are unfamiliar with the track would find some of the words stark and not in line with what they would expect to hear on air." Now, other BBC channels, such as BBC Radio 2, will air the original version. The track was censored once before on Radio 1 back in 2007, and shortly after that, they reversed the decision. So it's been back and forth, and this seems to come up every year. And it's become a bit of a touch point for people that want to argue back and forth around the limits of, you know, PC culture and of whether you can apply modern standards to something that was made at a time and place when it may not have carried those connotations and this, that, and the other. So, John, I feel like we've talked about this every year, but here we are again. Fairy Tales back in the news. Are you fired up? Are we tired of this? Is it?
I don't recall speaking about this ever before, but yes, I am fired up. This is a stupid thing. Listen. Faggot is not a nice word, and you should not call people that. Slut is not a nice word, and you should not call people that. But I think there's a lot to unpack here. First of all, Adam, I don't even fully agree with your synopsis. You weren't like defining every angle here, but you said maybe these words weren't offensive then, but they're very offensive now, which is true. However, I think it's extremely important to note is the characters that they're portraying in the song are two essentially loser characters, two characters that are down on their luck and are not nice. And they're using not nice words towards each other. They're not even using the words in the correct context when you think about it. And so I think it is extremely problematic for us to go back and change history, but only change history for us to require our villains, if you will, in literature to adhere to certain guidelines to make them seem nicer. The point of the song isn't that these people are nice, and the point of the song isn't that these people are awesome for using these words. The point of the song is, look at how wretched these people are and look at how they speak. You want to be better than that. That's the point of the song. So we become so sensitive that we can't even make the message that certain ways of behaving are bad, that we can only talk about nice things and can't talk about things that will upset people. And I think, I mean, this happened a few years ago at this point, but at this point, we can't even talk about things if it'll upset people. Well, I hate to tell you, the world is an upsetting place, and it's an especially upsetting place right now. And so that's how it is. But also, I mean, it's the same argument when people try to take the N-word or ban Mark Twain. Mark Twain's entire point is that racism is wrong, particularly in Huck Finn. I mean, Huck Finn is an extremely anti-racist book. And people are like, oh, they use the N-word, we should ban that book. You're missing the point entirely. And so you're either missing the point entirely or you want to ignore history and say, oh, well, because the history in the past was upsetting people, we shouldn't talk about it, which is the dumbest thing in the world. I mean, there's the extremely well-worn line. If you don't know your history, you're doomed to repeat it. So it is extremely important to let people know about these things, particularly in the case of Fairy Tale New York, where the point is they're saying bad things because they're bad people. It'd be different if it was like an 80s hair metal band and they were like, we don't like F. You know, that's not what this song is. It's the exact opposite of that. So it is stupid and short-sighted, and I would say even dangerous to censor that. I mean, it certainly is dangerous to censor that because, as we've seen before, censoring one thing certainly opens up the floodgates to censor more and more till eventually the only thing you can get is state propaganda, if you will, you know. And state propaganda – actually, I meant to bring this up earlier in this conversation. I was thinking about this today. The huge problem of 2016 to 2020 was that Trump and his cronies lied and didn't tell the truth and gave out propaganda that was inoffensive to their core base and created an echo chamber for their core base and made their core base worse and worse and worse. And the people on the left said that was a bad thing for Trump to do. And I agree 100%. But now those same people, if you will, are saying, oh, well, we definitely should censor these words because they're upsetting. No, you can't censor reality. You can't censor what's real. This was the whole point of 2016 to 2020, that, you know, creating false lexicons, creating false realities and acting as if that's true, ignoring the past, ignoring reality is an extremely dangerous thing to do. And this past year, you know, with the poor kids in cages, you know, with police brutality, ignoring reality and not talking about things because they're scary and upset us is an extremely dangerous path to go down that we almost didn't come back from, knock on wood. I think we're looking a little bit better now, knock on wood. But, you know, I didn't really learn our lesson. And so to censor this, I think, is a stupid and short-sighted thing. And it's dumb. Lastly, I believe, and I'm not the only person that have said this, I believe this kind of thing is what creates Proud Boys to begin with, because when you get overly hot on the censorship thing and, oh, you're an evil person for even saying this word, even if you're saying it as in a negative context, then that's how these Proud Boys say, oh, well, we can't talk in the mainstream, so we're just going to have to go underground. And we're going to get in our own echo chamber underground, and we're going to bubble up and bubble up. And eventually they bubble up and explode and have the chaos that we had in 2019 and 2020. I think this is stupid and short-sighted, and I guess we're not learning our lesson. And that's my opinion.
See, the bringing up the Proud Boys there is, I think, the angle of this that I thought was sort of interesting. And that there was a Vice writer that was talking about the controversy here. And the Pogues went and retweeted his opinions on it, which I thought were kind of interesting. And what he said was, he said, the word itself being in Fairy Tale of New York doesn't bother or offend me, but straight people being so angry and outraged at its removal and literally fighting and arguing for the right to sing it bothers me deeply. Now,
I disagree with 100%.
No, but I think you got to look at the angle that he's commenting on there, because I think it is similar to one that you actually are.
His angle is different than my angle. I think. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Adam.
Right. He's not arguing for or against the word, and he's not arguing, I think, for or against the point that you're making. What he's finding disturbing is, and I could absolutely picture the MAGA style, Proud Boy style crowd latching on to something like this. This is exactly the kind of low hanging controversy that the people that are the people on that end of the spectrum that are looking to gin up a bigger controversy than there needs to be are going to grab and latch on to and use as one more example of how the left is trying to take away their freedoms and their God-given rights to do what they want. And then what you're going to have is you're going to have these Proud Boy style folks, you know, they're going to be gathered. Could you not picture them gathering in a big group and singing the song together? And then they all scream the word faggot at the same time when they get to that part, you know, beating their chests and smiling at each other like idiots. Like you can picture that reaction where this meme-y, snarky alt-right that's looking for something to grab onto and to gin up other people to jump into the confrontation with them. This is exactly the kind of thing that they're looking for. That, you know, so it, in a way, I think that the opinion of the writer that I'm quoting here, he's not arguing for or against the censorship. What he's saying is that this is the kind of thing that those people that are looking to stir shit, it's just going to be more fuel on the fire for them to stir shit with and for them to go get everyone worked up in, and, you know, and not getting people worked up because it's a legitimate issue of censorship or, you know, or anything like that, but just getting people worked up because, oh, look, it's another thing that we can use to, you know, get everyone mad at the left. And that's not helpful in trying to, I don't know, bring people together. So I think that was an interesting take on it, because and I that's the one that the Pogues took and they shared too, where you kind of got the impression from the Pogues sharing that they are saying I got the impression that I'm reading a lot out of like the two or three words that the Pogues have said about this on Twitter recently, but they're tired of this controversy. They think it's a little bit ridiculous. Even back in the day, they recorded two versions of the song that had different lyrical content because they knew they were going to need the one for the one context anyways. So, you know what? They're not bothered by everyone getting into a froth about it, but they are bothered about people that are going to stand up and beat their chest about their right to scream faggot because they see that as like a transgressive act. And I think that's an interesting angle.
That's not how I read his comment mostly. We could drag this conversation out. One thing I do want to add, though, is I think this whole argument is inherently sexist, and so we're very upset over the F word, but slut. Oh yeah, also we took that out as well. So what I want to know is why is it such a criminal? And that's what's annoying about this is that this rule is not enforced uniformly, and it's a bad rule to begin with, but it's not even enforced uniformly. Why is it so horrible to question a male's sexual preferences, and that's the worst thing in the world? Oh, but call a woman a slut, that's bad, but that's not that bad, when it's the exact same thing aimed at women. You see what I'm saying? So like, why is that so unequal, that issue?
So, Em, you are younger than John and I.
Yes.
You're potentially young enough that you have not encountered fairy tale being just something that happens to be on the radio, or if you did, it is likely something that the first time you heard it, you stopped and you were like, "Oh, okay, that's in this song." which I'm just saying that because like that was my I can distinctly remember like the first time I heard it on the radio or something, and it's, you know, it's one of those things where I had to like stop and turn my head and go, "Whoa, okay." How does this read to you? How does someone of the generation that was not brought up, let's say, in between the two cultural movements react to this? Is it something that you can accept? Is it offensive?
Well, just like for the first part of the the first time I heard it was like, wait, what's that? Like, excuse me. And I think I looked it up online or something afterwards. And it was kind of surprising because it was like, oh, okay, well, you don't hear that very often and for good reason. So I started kind of looking into it a bit too, like, and again, like I get the context with it's, they're portraying characters. They're not nice people. You don't want to end up in a situation like that. You don't want to be those people, you know? And I think that that's a good thing, you know, cause you're telling a story and it's like a, you know, like a bit of a play, you can picture it and everything. So on that, it's interesting. But like it was and is like kind of shocking to hear it. I did look something else up where I don't know how accurate this is or anything, but so the band's from Ireland and apparently the word means just lazy person and it doesn't necessarily have like a connotation with sexuality. But
I didn't
again,
know that. I didn't know that at all, honestly. Adam, did you know that?
Only in that I saw people getting in a both sides argument about it. So some I saw someone make that point on Twitter attached to that same thread I was just talking about. And then, you know, someone else chimed in and gave the, you know, well, what does it matter what it may have meant in a certain context? Why doesn't it matter about who it's harming now, right? And then they're all going back and forth about that. So
well, I don't agree with that argument either. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I interrupted you.
Yeah, no worries. But like that's the whole thing, right? Like it's context. Like, you know, like if they meant it in like the lazy person way or whatever, you know, and not the like sexuality way, like that would kind of change perception. But again, only people like who grew up in Ireland or even that county or whatever would, you know, kind of get that. So I think that's something kind of interesting. And one other thing, just with censorship. And I know that when I was younger and I was getting into music, I had an iPod and one of the rules was I had to have censored version of music on it. And I hated it. And I looked like kind of as soon as I could, it was like, you know, get on the internet, find the real version, listen to the real version, hear all the swear words or whatever. So I think if you censor it 100%, it's going to cause more people to look into it and like maybe like you guys are saying with like the Proud Boys stuff, have these things be like, oh, look, we're edgy and we're taking whatever back and look at the hill we're gonna die on kind of thing, right? So another thing too, I don't understand why one radio station is censoring it but the other one isn't. That makes no sense.
There's a whole universe regarding the various BBCs that we are not qualified to speak to the impact that they have. It's like they're like different multiversal earths or something like that. Like it's not just like, oh, BBC 7, whatever, it's just the next channel. Like no, there's a whole thing regarding which of those you're on, I guess. What bothers me is the lack of sophistication by which people are trying to consume this piece of art in particular. And like, I don't know if it just, what it speaks to maybe not a lack of education, cause I don't think people are dumb, but I think what it speaks to is it speaks to a willful lack of nuance on the part of the people that are, I think, arguing that are arguing this issue. And I'm going to say a lack of nuance on both sides on this, where if, you know, again, if you listen to the song, you are listening to, especially that part of the song in particular, you're listening to dialogue between two characters. And again, dialogue between two characters that are not meant to be, you know, role models. They're not meant to be people you emulate. They're not meant to be people that you, you know, emphasize with. It's meant to be an amusing and quippy back and forth between two lowlives at that point. So to ignore all that, to ignore all the context and to ignore what that song actually is, and to just latch on to the word and either latch on to the word from the stupid perspective of, you know, it's my God-given right to sing that word out loud, or the other stupid perspective, which is we have to hide that word and erase it from history or harm will happen. Like, both of those perspectives are stupid to me. Like, both of them are ignoring a good deal about what that piece of art actually is. And you can only really embrace one or the other if you decide that you are going to, like, not actually engage with what the Pogues put together there. So it strikes me as like a very online type of controversy, a very online type of conversation, the kind of thing that people can just like scream shit at each other on Twitter back and forth about it. And I don't like engaging in the world that way, at least increasingly so. Yeah. John, what do we do? Nothing?
I think we solved it, Adam. No, honestly, what do we do? The answer is we act like human beings and we think about things critically and we understand that things have nuance and that one hammer isn't the solution to every problem in the world, and we think with nuance and substance and critically and understand that art is multifaceted and doesn't have to be and shouldn't be, this is good, this is bad. Art can be beyond the digital mindset, if you will. How you like that, Adam? Digital mindset. How you like that?
I didn't like their first album. All right, so we...
That was good, Adam. I liked it.
Yeah, so anyways, I don't know. There you go. The fairy tale controversy is back. I mean, I maybe we haven't talked about it between you and I on this show, but like God, it feels like this is the kind of thing where it's just like, you know, we're getting towards the Christmas season. People need something stupid to get mad about. They're going to get mad about this again. And not even that they're going to get mad about the song, but they're going to get mad at what the other side is saying about the song. And I think that's what drives me so crazy. It's like no one's actually arguing with the context of Fairy Tale. Everyone's just arguing with what the guy on the left or the right who they don't like is saying about the song. And blah. Anyways, there we go. Other than that, it's a delightful song. It fills me with joy. So here we go.
You know, I was going to say.
What were you going to say?
No, we've discussed this at length. Move on, Adam.
We've moved up.
Next ticket, please.
Next ticket. All right. So this is surprising news for some because it's a little bit after the fact. But the label Superior Viaduct has announced they're going to release the first ever official Screamers record. So the Screamers were an exceptionally influential punk band coming out of the early LA scene. Really one of the first notable synth punk acts in that vein. So the band was founded by Tomata Duplenty, who was the vocalist. There was Tommy Gear on synths. There was David Brown, who played an electric piano. I think he played like a Rhodes. And then there's KG Barrett, who was on drums. So you got two keys, vocalist and a drummer. They underwent a bunch of lineup changes with Paul Rossler eventually joining. Now the band was huge in the LA punk scene as a live band. They were one of the, I think they were one of the only bands that ever like headlined, as it was the Roxy. Is that the LA club? Am I getting my
club? Adam, excellent reference. Wow.
Right, but Adam, I'm not mixing up my American club names, right? Like it is a Roxy, right?
No, but Roxy, very famous LA club.
They're I think the only unsigned band to ever headline the Roxy at that time. They played, you know, all throughout that area. They went over to New York and they played CBs and things like that. So they were, you know, credited as they were like lauded as a live band. They never managed to pull together a proper record. What they actually were planning to do was they decided, and this was like pre-MTV, they decided that their first record was going to be a film, and they went in and they started working on that, but it never really happened. The band fell apart by like 1980 something, early 1980s. And then that was kind of it. Tomata Duplenty became a visual artist, but he passed away in 2000. So what Superior Viaduct has now is what they're claiming is, and I added claiming in here, that's my weasel word, is the first ever official recordings from the band. The record is called Demo Hollywood 1977. It's coming out on January 22nd of next year. It is going to include, it's an EP really, it's going to include the songs Magazine Love, Punisher Be Damned, Anything, Mater Dolores, and Peer Pressure. So you can hear Punisher Be Damned. It's linked up on Punk News right now. You can go stream it. So Screamers were insanely influential, hugely influential on bands like the Dead Kennedys in particular. Like Jello talked about them all the time. John, is this the band's first official release? And if so, how?
I'm surprised you're arguing that it's not, Adam. I mean, the big thing, what? Well, actually,
I'm less arguing against it. Oh. I'm more confused about how this comes together.
Okay, here's how it comes together. So there are actually a number of Screamers bootlegs, two which sort of act as faux albums. There's a double CD set that has almost everything they ever recorded, didn't release, but recorded. And then there's an album. Oh, no, actually, there's three. There's the double CD set. There's an album called Demo 77 to 78. And there's a recently released record called The Geza X Demos, which is fantastic and my very favorite Screamers release. All three of those records have roughly the same songs on them. These are one of these bands that did like five or six demos, like so they record the same songs over and over and over. All those releases are unofficial. For a while, the guy in A Better World, two CD release. That guy was claiming it was official, but it actually wasn't official at all because it wasn't authorized by any party that had the rights to release it. So the idea what no one's exactly sure why they were so against it. Tomata Duplenty did an interview with Jack Rabbit of Big Takeover magazine that Jack Rabbit reposted about a year ago. And this is in the late 90s where Jack Rabbit was hanging out with Tomatu. And Tomatu Duplenty basically said, wasn't that we like didn't want to do an album. We were just doing this video thing and it fell apart and no one really cared anymore. And then so the other main screamer is Tommy Gear. And Tommy Gear famously disappeared right after the Screamers, and like no one knows where he is or who he is, but people do know actually where he is and who he is. And about a year ago, I was poking around and I said, oh, does anybody know Tom? Because I was like, well, maybe I'll, because sadly Tomatu's dead. So I'm like, well, you know, sometimes, like, honestly, sometimes the only reason something cool doesn't come out is because nobody asked. And the worst they can say is no. And so I'm like, well, maybe I'll ask Tommy Gear. Say, Tommy Gear, you know, a lot of people love this record. Why don't we just put out an official one? There's lots of bootlegs. Let's put out an official one and we'll get you some money. You know, and so I was poking around. It was really hard to find him. And I found people that knew Tommy Gear. And the response was basically, you're an asshole for asking where Tommy Gear is. He doesn't want to be contacted by anybody. Leave him alone. You're a prick. Not quite like that, but that was essentially the message I got. So I'm like, all right. Well, I guess that's why no Screamers material is coming out ever, you know? And then about 8 months later, we get this announcement, which I'm thrilled and very happy to see. And so basically, Tommy Gear, the word is that he's a professional guy. Like, I thought he was a weirdo, but the word is that he's like a professional guy, but he actually might be a weirdo anyways. And so he really just didn't want it to come out, because he didn't care and he didn't want to be associated with that anymore. And you can understand that from a certain degree, because even though from the outside looking in, we see, oh man, the Screamers were awesome. You don't know what was going on in people's lives. And sometimes when people create their very best art, that was the absolute hardest of their personal life. And I'm not saying that's the case for Tommy Gear, because I don't know, but that might explain why he like was so against being contacted by anybody and never released any screen. I'm always astounded when like these amazing artists, Danzig included, when they have this amazing material that is being bootlegged like crazy and is easy money, but not only is it easy money, it's a fantastic piece of art that should be out there, and they just don't care. You know, I'm always astounded by that, and I don't know why Tommy Gear was like that, but apparently he's changed his mind, and this is coming out in Superior Viaduct. So that's why this is the first official Screamers release ever. What's interesting about this is, I already ordered myself a copy. It's their very first demos, which are probably slightly different than people are might have been accustomed to hearing. Most people, when they hear the Screamers, they've heard the album 77 to 78, which is kind of them doing their songs at full power. The demos here are like the earliest versions of their songs, and they're very cool, but they're a little bit slower and a little bit moodier. And I would say the Screamers not yet at their full power, but they are cool. But I was surprised these are what's coming out, and not either the 77 to 78 demos, or even more so, the Gaza X demos, which I think is without question the greatest unreleased punk rock album ever. Maybe even the greatest unreleased album ever. Bro.
Yeah, so I mean, that's where I was asking about it being the first official release. Like from the one standpoint, you can ask the philosophical question of, if a band has not been around for 35 years or whatever it is, does anything that has retroactively been released at that point after that band's demise really count as their quote unquote first record? Or is it just, you know, by consequence of time, always going to be an archival release one way or the other? And
oh, I see. I didn't answer your question at all. The answer is yes, this is the first official release, and here's why. Anything released before this was not authorized by the band. Therefore, by default, it was an unofficial release. But is that the question?
Well, yeah, but then also, like, was this material available prior on any of those demo bootlegs or things like that then?
Yes, it was on bootlegs, yes.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's not like we're going to say, like, oh, there was this band, they were called the Sex Pistols. No one ever heard their record, but it would have been really cool. And, like, you know, someone moves a rock when they're, you know, redoing a street in London, and, you know, under the King's Road, there's a fucking box, and in it is the Sex Pistols record no one's ever heard. And they go, oh, here it is. We can all hear it now. Right? Like, this is material that's been circulating, that's been known. And it's just the other fact that, you know, the fact that the lead vocalist of the band, you know, is now gone. So are they, how much agency would they have had necessarily? How much intent would they have had in this material getting out? It just, you know, I'm not questioning the legitimacy of what Superior Viaduct's putting out here. It's just, you know, it's interesting to stew over. Is like, you know, like how much of this is. Is it the first official entry in the Screamers discography? And how much is this just a, you know, fairly well approved archival release, but yet another sort of archival release? I'm not asking you to answer.
You and I just, and this is why this is a good show. You and I have very different perspectives on, although we have similar perspectives on some things, but to you, the interesting fact was, well, this has already been out, so it's a nicer version of what's already out. So is it that big of a deal? And to me, I'm like, wow, this is a huge deal because finally Tommy Gear is giving the thumbs up to something. So you and I are approaching the same thing but focusing on different attributes, and so we're both right, even though our final opinion is the exact opposite.
Both right. All right. Any Screamers weigh in here? I realize
we've been... who's right and who's wrong? Adam or John?
That's not fair. You both make good points. I thought it was really interesting how, like, after all the bootlegs, they finally come out with something official. And with stuff like this, it kind of, like, blows my mind how... without the bootlegs and without this release, like, they live on in people's minds, but they wouldn't really live on after those people were gone, you know? So it's really good to see, like, a really good band get more, put out something official, kind of solidify their place, you know?
I guess they weren't getting paid from those Chinese fireworks, eh, John?
Yeah, Adam Wright. Adam White with reference number 3 on fire. Adam, man, did you drink a cup of coffee before this episode or something? You're fired.
Yeah. So there was a story, listener, from a couple years ago, right?
Right.
Yeah,
maybe 2 years ago.
Yeah, where I mean, so John always plucks these like banned copyright infringement stories out of the ether. I don't know how you find them. But the one that you dug up the one day was that someone had taken the Screamers logo, like this super famous stylized picture of like a screaming head with like really spiky like hair, like he's been electrocuted. And they had repurposed it for like fireworks, and it was the logo on these, you know, made somewhere overseas fireworks, and John brought it to the world's attention. At least I'm giving you credit for it.
I did. It was me. It was me. I saw all this.
Yeah, there you go. You can put that on your resume. So anyways, yeah. What are we doing? So yeah, so there's some official Screamer stuff coming out. That's exciting because the Screamers are influential. There is more and more like a really cool, gnarly synth punk that seems to be happening in the universe, or at least I keep stumbling into it and being pleasantly surprised by it. So this is a band that is, I think, more influential these days than they would have seemed a few years ago, you know? So cool stuff. Do we want to, yeah, you know what? Let's play a song and then we're going to come back and then we'll talk about this next one, because this next one is a lot of shit to dig through. So, John, you want to play something?
Yes, I will. I will play a song that links into our previous two stories. It links into long forgotten bands from the 1980s that no one knows about, and also the concept of old terms being read in a modern context and being offensive. And what's interesting is I found this with my cousin's kids and some younger punks in the Philly punk scene, is that like racism and certain like really upsets them. Like you watch like a lot of movies from like the mid 80s and early 80s. There's a lot of stuff that would be considered like extremely offensive now. And it's like the younger people, that's it genuinely upsets them, there's differences in generations. And so anyways, I know a younger person in the punk scene and I sent the person this track. The singer is – well, the band is called Susan Ree and the Orientals. And the band is from 1980, and this really upset this young – I realized that that term is an offensive term now, but it was 1980. And I sent this to this person not to offend them. Say, I was like, oh, check out this track. And she was like totally upset by like the name of the band. So anyways, Susan Ree and the Orientals was a band from 1980. And Susan Ree is from Korea. And I guess that's why she named her band that. But this was really upsetting to this younger person, which surprised me. Anyways, she's got a 4-track EP and I think a 2-track or a 2-track 12-inch single. She is now an actress going by like Vicky Ree or something like that. And actually she's in like in a lot of Marvel movies and other, she's basically a character actress and she's in like a ton of movies. If you look her up, for like a minute, you know? But anyway, so she was in a new wave band in the '80s and she put the second EP is not as good, but the first EP just called Susan Ree and it's got 4 songs and the whole thing is great. I think the title track is fantastic. I used to talk about a band called Posers, which is broken up now. And I heard this song and I'm like, oh my God, this sounds like an unreleased Posers track, except for it came out literally 40 years before Posers or 35 years before Posers. So anyway, I just think this is a super awesome, totally forgotten, totally obscure new wave / punk track by Susan Ree. And it is called Little Miss Perfect.
Yeah.
All right, we're back. That was Susan Rhee. And we are...
Oh, I'm sorry. Little Miss Proper. Not Little Miss Perfect, Adam. Little Miss Proper.
Oh, all right. Well, you know what? People heard you correct yourself, so I'm not fixing it. So, all right. Here we go. This one, I've seen this story percolating around, and I thought it was worth bringing in because it seems to be something that John would have an opinion on. So,
yeah,
we are at a strange moment in this ongoing pandemic that we're in which we are starting to learn that the vaccines that they have been, you know, working on are apparently effective and working. And that's amazing news. But we are also at a point where we don't yet have these beautiful little scientific miracles flowing through our veins. So we're just sort of stuck waiting for them to figure out the logistics of actually getting this to everyone. And then the actual science of, you know, how many people need to have these things before we reduce transmission enough that we can start to return to, you know, something approximating normal. Well, business is not waiting, so they've got all kinds of plans. So the one that is interesting from a music standpoint here is Ticketmaster has been publicly musing over some of their plans about how they are going to resume their multi-zillion-dollar concerting ticketing empire in 2021. So this is what they have been discussing. And I'm going to put a big pin in this right now, and I'm going to say, yeah, we're going to talk about Ticketmaster and like giant concerts where Ticketmaster is a factor here. This, of course, has no bearing on your poor, beleaguered, you know, local indie venue, which, you know, if it even survives the pandemic, is going to be a goddamn miracle. But as you will see, this is the realm of big money. So Ticketmaster has been trying to work on a framework for for post-pandemic pan safety or fan safety. And here's what they want to do. They are wanting to digitize much more of the experience than they are and use those digital hooks that they're going to put into you as the Ticketmaster purchaser to verify that you are not a biohazard trying to come into whatever event that they are having. So what they're going to do is they want you to buy your Ticketmaster ticket using their app, using their digital system, which is probably something that already exists. But then they want to tie into that verification that you are either vaccinated or, and this is the part that's a little bit more curious to me, that you are recently tested within a certain window. And if you are able to prove via all of these mechanisms that they want to put in place that you are either vaccinated or not infected with COVID-19, then I suppose then it allows you into the event that you've purchased a ticket for. This involves, though, a whole bunch of logistics that have all kinds of interesting things that we could hit on from just a scale of the operation angle to a privacy angle to a rights angle. So I'm going to give you a little read out of this Billboard article here, because the amount of stuff that they're expecting to have in place and working well for this is kind of astonishing. So I'm going to read this now. They said, here's how it will work. If approved, after purchasing a ticket for a concert, fans would need to verify that they have already been vaccinated, which would provide approximately 1 year of COVID-19 protection. That's what Ticketmaster is saying. I don't know how Ticketmaster knows that. And they said, or test negative for coronavirus approximately 24 to 72 hours prior to the concert. The length of coverage a test would provide would be governed by the regional health authorities, If attendees of a Friday night concert have been tested 48 hours in advance, most could start the testing process the day before the event. If it is a 24-hour window, most people would likely need to be tested the same day of the event at a lab or a health clinic. Once the test is complete, the fan would instruct the lab to deliver the results to their health pass company, which is, in this example, either IBM or a company called Clear, which is all in caps. So if the tests were negative or the fan was vaccinated, the health pass company would verify the attendee's COVID-19 status to Ticketmaster, which would then issue the fan the credentials needed to access the event. If a fan tested positive or didn't take the test to verify their status, they would not be granted access to the event. So that's how Ticketmaster is envisioning all this working. I think John is going to probably approach this from a rights standpoint. So I'm going to approach this.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah, you are. I want to approach this from maybe an IT standpoint beforehand, which is that interoperability between different systems used by different companies is something that is not achieved easily and often quite fraught to get working in a timely manner. And for this, all this shit to be in place where you have health companies with rules that are determined by individual regions, somehow facilitating tests for people that are getting astonishingly fast results, at least given the way the tests seem to be going, in November of 2020, right? Like getting astonishingly fast results and then communicating that information to fucking IBM, who is then communicating that information to Ticketmaster so that they can somehow, electronically unlock you being able to go into the event that you've already purchased the ticket for, which I guess that you purchased a ticket for on spec that all this shit was going to work. It just seems like a leap too far as anyone actually getting it together. And the reason why I would be extremely skeptical of that is, like, look at what happened when we've had like the actual height of the emergency. So in the height of the emergency right now, we have had the tech companies, Google and Apple, banded together in a kind of astonishing show of non-competition. And they rush put together a extremely privacy-focused and actually technically very cool system of exposure notifications that they built into the APIs of their phones and then distributed that to the people in the world that have Android and iOS devices. And there's sort of like a Herculean effort for them to actually make that happen. And to make that happen and to get all that interoperability happening was really because, we were at like peak, everything is going to be fucked because of the virus, pressures on things. So they did all that work, and that the rollout of that technology to people is still all snarled up in a lot of places of the world because of dumb bureaucracy. So if you look at Canada, for example, Canada went and they had an app, which is what's the name of the app? Emma, is it like the COVID-19?
COVID Alert.
COVID Alert. They had an app called COVID Alert that was built on top of these publicly available APIs that Google and Apple put together. So you can actually, go and you can read the full specs of these APIs online. They open sourced all the code for this stuff. There's no mystery about what any of it does from a privacy standpoint. And they still have totally abysmal uptake of it in Canada because they can't get people to get over the fact that they think it's spying on them. The same people who are fucking plugging their shit into Instagram and Facebook and Amazon all day long are that they don't trust the app, which they could see the code for, that is meant to tell them if they've been near someone that has coronavirus or not. And it's not just like, it's not just your dumb aunt on Facebook that doesn't trust the thing. Fucking Alberta hasn't adopted it. So we have one of the biggest provinces in the country decided we're going to make our own app because we don't trust this other one, that where all the work was already done for us by Google and Facebook and Apple, and they made their own, and it doesn't fucking work in the right way either. And they're having a bigger problem than anyone else. So with like, with best efforts at the height of the problem, where for some bewildering reason, the big two evil tech companies got together and actually did something good for it, the government of Canada can't even force anyone to use the thing to a point where it would be effective. So if all of that could not work logistically, I really, really doubt that at the point where the virus is on the wane, Ticketmaster is going to be able to get IBM and all these regional health people and all these testing companies to all fall in line to use this cockamamie system that they've come up with. It just seems totally unrealistic. But that said, John, this thing sucks, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah, it totally sucks. It sucks for many reasons that Adam illustrated. And also, that doesn't even beg the question, well, how come all these private corporations are taking care of this when really the government really should have a firm hand in solving these issues as well? That being said, this is extremely scary. I don't know about extremely, but it's very scary. And now, and listen, and let me back up here. I am extremely pro COVID fighting COVID, wearing masks, social distancing, staying home a while. I am extremely pro that. I don't think the COVID thing is fake or trumped up or whatever. I think it's a very, very, very real threat. That being said, it is this is very problematic. Like, you can't go to a concert without giving the private corporation Ticketmaster, who time and time and time again has been hit with doing unethical things, such as charging extra money for tickets for no value whatsoever, such as directly selling tickets to third parties so they get more money, such as advising ticket bot controllers how to use their ticket bots to quickly buy tickets from people that should be able to buy those tickets otherwise. We are trusting them with our medical data, and not only that, we are requiring them to be able to view our medical data to go see a show. I mean, this really is like a dystopian future where, like, you can't even go in a supermarket, or, you know, like these sci-fi movies, whatever, you know, to go to a supermarket, you have to get scanned and get approved to buy certain things by some mysterious entity. But in those movies, it's usually a mysterious government entity. Here, it's even worse. It's a predatory and mysterious private entity that gets to look at your – that gets all this extremely personal info. They get to decide what you can and cannot do. It's crazy. With private corporations, you should be one factor only, generally speaking. Here's the money. Give it to me. And that's it. You know, and so this extreme, and also not only that, is this opens them up. It allows them to charge more for whatever that, not like they don't want to charge enough, but also it opens the door for them to require other types of info, which, astounding to a lot of people, people are so willing to turn over the private info, which used to be so protected for the most minor convenience. People turn over their social security numbers, their birth dates, anything, you know, the driver's license numbers for anything, and to go in these hands in nefarious corporations who also get hacked all the time. This is a stupid plan. It's a bad plan. I hope it fails. And agree or disagree, or in the middle.
Probably in the middle, but leading towards, like, this isn't good, you know, because Ticketmaster is not great. They don't have a great track record. I don't know too much about IBM. I know they made the Watson guy who was on Jeopardy, but, like, how secure are IBM?
This whole thing feels like this should not be Ticketmaster. Like, Ticketmaster should not be facilitating this system. Like, they should not be the ones that are trying to solve for this. So, like, let's say that you are in, let's say we are in a realm where they say, you know what, to be able to go not even to a concert. Let's say to be able to travel between nations in the short term where there's still rampaging virus everywhere. We are going to need some way to verify that you, the individual, are not taking a contagion from point A to point B. So you know, they're going to call that, like, let's say you have like an immunity passport, a vaccination passport, which also sounds dystopian, but let's say you have that, right? So, you know, John, if you want to get on a plane and go to New Zealand, New Zealand is going to want to know that you are not a health risk coming into New Zealand. So let's say that's the reality. I don't actually think that's going to be the reality, because honestly, what I think is going to happen is that people are going to get vaccinated and the borders are going to remain closed. And then once enough people are vaccinated and the numbers are under control, then things start to open. And it's way less complicated than, you know, fucking Ticketmaster's making it out to be. But let's say that we do need these kinds of things. Let's say the vaccines don't work really well, but we get things under control somewhat. But New Zealand needs to know if John Gentile is infectious coming into the country or not. So there does need to be some communication from, you know, from U.S. health authority XYZ to the government of New Zealand that you are able to come. So, which means that somewhere there has to be a database where it says John Gentile is clean. So if that kind of thing has to exist, and I'm not advocating for that to exist, privacy wags, but if that had to exist, would you not kind of want that to be in the purview of governments and not in the purview of like Ticketmaster and all of their corporate partners?
Yeah, but I mean, Ticketmaster is doing that because they want the cash. I mean, that's the only reason they're doing it. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, right. But then, like, compound that out, right? If Ticketmaster comes up with a way to do this, and it is successful in allowing them to start making money because people are attending their events again, well, there's other entities to which people go that are going to then start doing similar things. And are all of the entities that do this going to, are they all going to have like a rock solid privacy set up? Like, quite likely not. Right. So, okay. So say Ticketmaster does this and it works, right? Okay, great. Well, now you want to go to Disneyland, John. Well, okay. So the Walt Disney Company comes up with their own, you know, privacy snake nest that you have to submit your health data through. But to get to Disney, you got to go on an American Airlines. So then American Airlines has their own system that does that, right? And it's just like, all of a sudden, all these private corporations have a whole bunch of health data that they're kicking around. And like, there's no way that they can all do that in a way that's going to keep it from being leaky. And
I hear you.
Like
Lewis.
Yeah, so it's just, this is, I mean,
it's messed up, man. That's what it is.
It's messed up, but it's messed up in a way that, like, I'm cautious for some reason that by commenting that this is messed up, I'm somehow going to sound like I'm an anti-vaxxer or one of these conspiracy nuts, and I am by no means any of those things. I mean, I would, you know, you could put like a whole fucking keg of vaccine into me tomorrow and I'd gladly take it and just see what happens. So don't get me wrong there, right? Like, just hook me up, right? My lack of faith is not in the science of that. My lack of faith is in big corporate being able to to manage this, and I don't think that they can.
One keg today, Frank. You got it, Adam. Do you need a tap? No, I'm just going to take it straight in the vein.
Yeah, it's just like if they came and they said, "Sir, you have to drink a pint of vaccine for the next 28 days," I would be like, "All right, fill me up. Let's go." All right. So, anyways, so yeah, Ticketmaster is scary. So they want to do this thing. We're going to talk about a couple more music things here before we wrap up this show that's already pretty long. John, Blood Clot's got some shit going on. Tell the people.
Yes. So the Cro-Mags battle rages forward, although at this point it's somewhat more of a passive-aggressive battle. Of course, as people know, John Joseph and Harley Flanagan were fighting for years and years and years. Last year it finally got settled with Harley Flanagan taking the name Cro-Mags and John Joseph and Mackie Jason taking the name Cro-Mags JM. Harley Flanagan put out one album and two EPs as Cro-Mags. They were all excellent. And there's a new Cro-Mags EP coming out before the end of the year called Cro-Mags 2020, which will probably be good because the last album was excellent. Meanwhile, everyone's like, well, is John Joseph going to come out with Cro-Mags JM material? And they even suggested that they were going to. But it looks like, no, they're not actually. Now they're going to come out with more Blood Clot stuff. And, of course, Blood Clot is basically the John Joseph solo band, whoever he happens to be playing with. Todd Youth was in the band with him, but quite sadly, Todd Youth passed away suddenly and tragically. So the new Blood Clot band is John Joseph and Tom Capone, and Manuel Carrero, and Darren Morgenthaler. So it's an entirely different band than the last Blood Clot. And, of course, the last Blood Clot was an entirely different band than the original Blood Clot from the 80s. And they've got a new track out called Save the Robots. And people are saying this is more like Cro-Mags than the last Blood Clot album, which was really almost more like a metal thrash album. I thought it was okay. I thought the music was good. I thought the lyrics were a little bit middle school. And what did you think of this? Is the Cro-Mags slash John Joseph battle worth following now, or is the battle over and we should just think about them as two separate artists, a la Thurston Moore and Kim Gordon?
I think of them as two separate artists. They made good stuff together, but they're not doing that anymore. You know, acknowledge the past happened. It was the past. Acknowledge the future is going on. They're doing their own thing. I thought it was okay. That was kind of it. Like, it was okay. It wasn't, oh my God, this is the best thing. And it wasn't, Jesus Christ, take it away. It was just okay. But overall, not bad. When it started, I was writing notes when I was listening to it, and the first thing I wrote down was Slayer influence, and I don't really think that's right. But the first, 50 seconds kind of reminded me of that, and I think it was because I was listening to Slayer before. But anyway, it's not bad. It's all right, and I'll see what more comes out of this.
Adam, you know, well said, Em. I'm taking the wait and see approach, which honestly is usually the best approach when it comes to music instead of jumping all over track. That's what we do on the show. Adam, you know, being that we've had the whole Proud Boys thing and the whole QAnon thing and even the whole anonymous thing is I feel maybe I read too deep into lyrics these days. Like, this song has lyrics blind leading masses of blind. What else it has? Free your mind, dim the lights to change their minds. And it's like, well, who's, it always has all these pronouns. It's like, who is they? Who are the blind leading the blind? Like, why is the song written in such a vague fashion? Now, if I heard this in the 90s, I'd say, oh, it's just a, you know, standard hardcore lyrics, you know? But in 2020, especially with people posting things on Instagram that I see, I'm like, oh, well, you know, do we have another, secretive guy on our hands? You know, I'm a big Morrissey fan, but the frustration with Morrissey is he won't say what he actually believes, you know, and so he writes vague statements, but we don't know what the hell he's talking about. Or Ice Cube with the whole Donald Trump thing, you know. Adam, am I reading are they just kind of like middle school lyrics, like blind leading the blind, and it doesn't really mean anything, it just sounds cool? Or are there secret hidden messages in here? Should we be looking for them?
I think we should be looking for them. I don't know if at some point, like, the nuts on the other end of the aisle stole all of our good foes. Like, you remember the Battle of Seattle era, you know, where everyone was out there protesting the WTO, and you had all these groups that all had like a different sort of axe to grind, whether it was environment or whether it was labor standards or, you know, whatever else. And they were all coming together to rattle the powers that be from what am I trying to express here? from trying to, you know.
That is an excellent live, Battle in Seattle, excellent live EP by the No World Trade Organization combo headed by Jelly Bean Afro.
Who was on that? Chris Novoselic and...
Kim Deal and one other person.
One other person of note, that's the thing. Fuck was it?
I'll look it up while you keep talking.
You look it up, anyways. Though, but like during that era, right, where we were rallying against like globalization, and we could look and say like globalization is bad for all of these reasons, right? But then now, like that whole language has been taken by the kooky internet alt right, where they're not fighting against like globalization because it's like undermining workers' rights. They're fighting against, you know. They're fighting against like similarly named forces, where it's more that like, oh, the secret one world government is trying to take America's power away and, you know, feminize all of our men and all of this stuff. And then you're like, whoa, hold on, that wasn't what we were fighting. So now they've, you know, it's been ruined. So yeah, lyrics where we would have seen them in the 90s and we would have been like, oh, this is just, you know, this is just a angry rock and roll band trying to fight the man. Now I read a lot of that stuff and I go like, is this some conspiracy nut who isn't trying to fight the man? And by man, they mean like, you know, global corporatism. But for them, the man is like the elders of Zion. And, you know, we don't want to be on that team. So, I don't know. I'm this like vague fight the power shit right now is fraught.
That's Adam, you are nailing out of the park today. That's the exact issue I had with this song. I'm like, not to get too well. I don't want to get too deep, but yeah, that's the issue I have with this song. Anyway, the No WTO combo: Jello, Kim Thaw, Chris Novoselic, and Gina Manwall of Sweet 76.
That record is awesome.
375, I mean, yes, it is an awesome,
you know, even the covers of the Dead Kennedy songs that are on that record are just like, they're all fired up and great. And you should go get that, people. Go grab that thing.
You literally can buy that record for like $2, like $1.23.
It's in the same bin as like Rock Against the Bush and all the other things that were politically relevant at some point, but no one remembers what they're about anymore. All right, really quick, there's another video that's out there from The Network. It is called Flat Earth. It, in many ways, tries to tackle in a cheeky, sarcastic way some of the things that John and I were just talking about there, which is like, you know, flat earthers and conspiracy theorists and all these people. I've got a read on this one, but Em, like, what'd you think? Were you... You into the wacky network song?
I thought it was funny. I got a kick out of it. It's like, not to be, how many people are gonna find it and listen to it and be like, ah, yes, I agree with all of the points, and then not realize that they're kind of making, well, they are making fun of them. So that was something I kind of thought of with it. But it's nice to see, just with all, well, like, both you were saying with the blood clot song, you know, so much, you have to read in so much, and so much could be hidden and everything. And then just with something like this, it's like, okay, conspiracy theory that's obviously wrong. We're just going to make fun of it.
Yeah, there's no questioning the network's intent here. Is this song too simplistic, though? Like, not musically or anything that, but like, I got the feeling listening to this that like it's not particularly clever or subversive. It's sort of saying really obviously that these silly things are ridiculous, but I don't know, but like not in a way that felt very smart to me. And I guess that's where I was not sure. I was really into the first of the two network songs that have sort of shown up in this era of the band. But this one, I was like, this is, I mean, I don't disagree with, you know, with making fun of flat earthers and everything else, but there's, It's all pretty on the nose. John, what do you think?
I think this is more than any Green Day thing I've heard in the past 25 years. And like I said, I think it's cool. They're having fun. And I do think I'm not a huge Green Day fan, but it is cool how even when they're not Green Day, they still want to hang out and record stuff and have fun. The criticism of Green Day is that, you know, they started at this will really piss off your mom. And they're still doing this will really piss off your mom. But maybe that's the function of Green Day. Green Day wasn't my juncture into punk rock and critical thinking, but maybe it is for some people, and maybe that's okay.
Especially if your mom is now a member of a QAnon Facebook group, then
I thought QAnon was just like some message board or whatever, but apparently like QAnon might just be like a specific group of people. Is that accurate?
I don't fucking know. I've tried not. It's one of those things where it's like, if I stare into the void, the void's going to look back at me. So I don't want to look at it too much. So it's just on my list of right wing internet nutters. And I'm not trying to understand them.
Well, I mean, honestly, Adam, you should check it out. They make some good points. I'm kidding.
All right, John, intro this last thing. And I'm going to use it for a song here to tell the people about butt stuff.
Butt Stuff is a I'm going to tell you about Butt Stuff. Butt Stuff is a band out of Ohio, and I don't know hardly anything about this band. The only reason I know about this band is I talk about this other band, Big Moose Man Holington, that does My Little Pony Ramones core tracks. Well, anyways, he, on his Facebook, he's like, everyone should check out Butt Stuff. And Butt Stuff is a band out of Ohio, and they did a Halloween set last year where they did SpongeBob SquarePants songs in a crust-punk style. And they only did one show or two shows, and they thought it was kind of a waste to like let all those funny versions of tracks just kind of disappear in the ether, as Adam stated. So they decided to record a 5-track EP where they play SpongeBob SquarePants songs in a crust-punk and folk-punk style. I think it's amusing and funny, and I enjoyed it, and I actually bought a cassette tape. And not only that, they seem like nice people because they sent me an email. They're like, hey, thanks for posting about our thing, which is different than most of the messages I get, which is, John, you're an asshole. How come you're not talking about this loser beard band? You know, so they seem like nice people. And Adam, I thought this was – I don't think this is anything super meaningful, but I think it's a fun diversion, and as the listeners know, I'm all for fun diversions. Adam White, here, I'm holding out the football for you. Come take a swing.
It's a fun diversion, but there's a far better spin on this stuff, which is to say there's a band out of Montreal called Barnacle. Barnacle, their whole shtick is that everything they sing about is about the sea and the beach. And there's a lot of SpongeBob crossover into Barnacle's lyrics and imagery, given the subject matter that they sing about. So, Barnacle for 420 in 2019, they released a live cassette tape called Live at the Salty Spittoon. There's a warped looking picture of SpongeBob smoking a doob on the front of the record. And, it contains some super gnarly versions of not necessarily SpongeBob songs, but some Barnacle originals that are all really fucking great in and of themselves. So I'm going to play you a song here from Barnacle. So I'm going to play the song, let's say, we're going to play Muscle Beach, which is a song by Barnacle from Montreal, which is a band I dearly love. And I'm sad that I can't see live right now because we have a super virus in the world. So here you go. This is Barnacle. We'll see you next week on the Punkness Podcast.
Hey, what's everyone waiting in line for?
Ahoy, fair lass. It be the line to get into the salty spittoon. The roughest, toughest sailor club ever to be built under the seven seas. Only the baddest of the bad can get in. You need to have muscles. You need to have muscles on your muscles. You need to have
been a while since I came back east. Wondering if my friends remember me. I'm a bum that's just a rolling muscle beat. Hometown Astro, Philly at my feet. In a
my feet.